it was on TV that the gong broke and it was all over.
The rumours have flown about the CIA and Secret Service connections of John Friedrich. Now, for the first time, there's a suggestion that he may actually have worked for our own defence forces, possibly under a false name.
I wish to repeat that I have not seen or heard from my son since 1974.
Welcome to our third and final episode of Hero or Con Man? The Case of John Friedrich. In this episode, we look at one of the biggest manhunts Australia has ever seen. We explore the rumours surrounding John Friedrich's identity and follow a trail leading to Germany. We also investigate who bears responsibility and how it is possible for Friedrich to keep up his scheme for so long without anyone asking any questions. Between 1977 and 1989, a man named John Friedrich transforms the National Safety Council of Australia, Victorian Division, the NSCA, into a kind of paramilitary organisation equipped with state-of-the-art high-tech gear. Banks willingly hand out one loan after another, but a competitor in Western Australia, Bill Meek, knows the numbers simply cannot add up. And he is right. It is December 1988. The newly appointed NSCA board commissions an additional special audit. On March 15, the following year, John Friedrich receives a letter. He is suspended and instructed to appear before the board a few days later with a full explanation of the organization's financial position. But that meeting never happens, because the previous day Friedrich disappears. It is March 20th, 1989. NSCA Public Relations Manager Bruce Savage remembers.
And in fact, the day that he disappeared, I spoke to him as he was leaving, and he said, I'm not sure whether this board meeting is going to go too well, and I don't know if I'll go. And that was the last I saw him. And then the next thing is he didn't turn up to the board meeting and he'd done a runner. So he was having to become a lot more accountable, and that didn't really suit John because he was a person that loved to be in control.
Many employees learn through the media that their boss has vanished and that the NSCA is on the verge of collapse, including pilot Tom Supple.
It was on TV that the gong broke and it was all over. It was funny. I stopped at the bank because there was some outstanding money that I hadn't picked up. But by the time I got there, the bank had already shut it all down. I seemed pretty quick. So that was the end of that.
For many of the organization's 450 employees, it comes as a shock.
I'm probably shocked that, it was pretty sudden. I don't think anybody really, there were rumors, but nobody, had any sort of feeling that anything was going wrong at that stage. It was just very sudden and it was all over.
Steve Taylor worked in search and rescue for the NSCA.
The day that it did go down and it finally collapsed and we realised it was a big Ponzi scheme, pretty much, I was wrecked, absolutely emotionally wrecked.
Competitors feel the impact too. Hugh Devin, then General Manager of Operations at SkyWest Airlines.
It left almost a vacuum because, one day it was there as this paramilitary force of very considerable substance and the next day it was nothing. And there were people ringing up saying, I've lost my job, you guys got any work? And it wasn't as though that their disappearance opened some opportunity to us or to other aviation companies, because a lot of the work that they were doing, they'd actually created themselves. So it wasn't as though someone in Canberra turned around and said, look, they've stopped doing this, can you guys do it and we'll pay you to do it or we'll set up a tender. There was just a complete vacuum, it just was gone. And the human side of it.
With the collapse of the NSCA and his disappearance, John Friedrich becomes Australia's most wanted man. His face is splashed across newspapers. Television stations report daily. There are alleged sightings in Australia and overseas, from New Zealand to Southeast Asia. For 16 days, police search for him. Meanwhile, investigations into the fraud continue. The NSCA is liquidated and an administrator appointed.
The provisional liquidators for the National Safety Council Victorian Division, chartered accountancy firm Ernst & Winnie, say they have evidence of irregular accounting practices by the company over several years. But they say much was kept secret from the honorary board members, with the former chief executive officer and now missing person, John Friedrich, keeping the company's accounts under close personal control.
Eventually, the search comes to an end. Friedrich is arrested at a campsite in Western Australia. During questioning, he cooperates, but one thing is still unclear. Who is this man? Even during his time at the helm of the NSCA, questions were raised about John Friedrich. Does he have a military background? Why are there so few photographs of him while his organization and staff appear everywhere? Was he really born in South Australia, as he claimed, or in South Africa? Or perhaps in Germany? Former NSCA Public Relations Chief Bruce Savage recalls.
None of us knew he was born in Australia because of his accent, you know, so I don't think he fooled too many people that way. So,
you know, his accent was still had a very German twang to it, I suppose. It's sort of I think it was a bit of a hybrid accent. I think he tried to make it Australian, but there was always these little words that would come out every now and then that would sort of, you know, you'd link back to being Deutsch or German.
The true identity of John Friedrich, who defrauded businesses and the banks of almost $300 million, is no longer a mystery.
As investigations continue, a trail leads to Germany. In Bavaria, people recognize the man, but under a different name.
We have him Benny genannt, the Benny brothers.
We called him Benny. It was either Benny or Fritz. So those are the two names I know him by. This is the first time I've heard the name Johann. I didn't know that.
Investigators piece together the following picture. John Friedrich was born Johann Friedrich Hohenberger on September 7th, 1950, in Munich. Fritz, as he was called as a child, attends a local school and later joins the local rescue service. He eventually works for the road and tarmac construction company Stratebau at a branch office in rural Bavaria. He is regarded as highly intelligent and is able to charm everyone. Only later does the company discover that Hohenberger applied using a forged passport and a fake diploma. It is there that Hohenberger meets Stelian Moculescu, a Romanian Olympian who used the chaos following the 1972 Munich Olympic attack to seek asylum in Germany. Friedrich, or Benny or Fritz, as he came to be known at Stratebau, helps him out with a car and a job at the construction company.
I don't know if others see him that way, but to me he was like Robin Hood. He helped out wherever he could. He was very down to earth. He didn't show off. I really can't say a single bad thing about him.
However, Hohenberger does not properly account for Moculescu's working hours. Officially employed as a laborer, Moculescu actually performs technical work. Moculescu recounts that Hohenberger would present construction sites as if they were his own projects, even though they actually belonged to another company. And yet, in Moculescu's eyes, he mainly inspires admiration.
He was undoubtedly a very interesting character, very complex character, with rough edges. But I think he had planned everything he did in advance and knew exactly what he was doing.
In 1974, Hohenberger disappears after swindling around 250,000 Deutschmarks from the company's head office under the pretense of a business deal. Today, this would be worth just over 200,000 Australian dollars. At this point, Hohenberger is 24 years old.
Broad Squad Detective Sergeant Martin Grinberg said Friedrich, whose real surname was Hohenberger, had fled West Germany in 1974 to evade charges of stealing a large amount of money from his employer.
There is a rumour going around that he died in an avalanche in Italy. Moculescu doesn't believe it.
As I saw it at the time, the situation was, and judging by the sort of person I think he was, I would have said, right. He's got it all well planned out and farewell, because he wasn't stupid.
Johann Friedrich Hohenberger, or Benny or Fritz, remains missing. The first time Moculescu hears from him again is when reports emerge in Germany about his fraud case in Australia. The same goes for Hohenberger's family. His mother later writes to police in Victoria. SBS has obtained a translated version of the letter.
I last saw my son Fritz Hohenberger on the 6th or 7th of December 1974. At that time, he said he would be going away on holiday and had told me goodbye. On the 7th of December, he rang me from Solden to inform me that everything was going well for him. That was the last contact I had with my son, Fritz. On the weekend of the 1st or 2nd of April 1989, my son Carl rang me and said, "Your son is alive." He told me to look in the weekend newspaper. I went to my neighbour and borrowed their paper. I found a heading, "So this is how Munich man makes world career." Underneath, there's a photo of a man. I was 100% sure it was my son, Fritz. Even without a name printed, I would have recognised him. I have now more newspaper cuttings, and I'm still 100% sure it is my son, Fritz. After my son vanished in Solden, my son Carl and I always believed that Fritz was still alive somewhere. It's just that we had never heard from him since that time. I wish to repeat that I have not seen or heard from my son since 1974. At that time, he was still single. I found out through the newspaper that my son had, in fact, got married in Australia. Before reading this, I knew nothing.
But how did this man arrive in Australia as John Friedrich? From here on, we leave Johann Friedrich Hohenberger, or Benny or Fritz, behind and return to the name Australia came to know, John Friedrich. He is said to have arrived in Sydney from Auckland, New Zealand on January 20, 1975. 2 days later, he pretended to board a flight to Europe. However, after passing through passport control, he allegedly never boarded the plane and instead disappeared into Sydney under the name John Friedrich. The Department of Immigration considered him an illegal immigrant. There are no records of a birth certificate or passport for John Friedrich. While the search for the missing man continues in Australia, the myth that surrounds him grows. His operations with federal departments, police and security agencies, including work connected to the secret US facility Pine Gap, fuel speculation. The NSCA was working alongside the Australian Federal Police in Pine Gap to provide security for a protest.
The rumours have flown about the CIA and Secret Service connections of John Friedrich. Now, for the first time, there's a suggestion that he may actually have worked for our own defence forces, possibly under a false name.
The rumours ultimately go nowhere.
All Friedrich's associates told the inquest how he had alluded to international conspiracies and covert operations. The police could prove none of it.
All of these allegations of espionage and certainly all the allegations of covert operations all proved to be baseless.
To this day, there is still no absolute clarity regarding his activities in this sphere. This is partly because John Friedrich himself likes to cultivate the image of a spy. In interviews, he neither confirms nor denies the rumours. This is in keeping with the enigmatic figure he is perceived to be, an intelligent man who captivates others. Hugh Devin, then General Manager of Operations at SkyWest Airlines.
He was a particularly pleasant individual. I mean, he was not the sort of guy that you would go to a meeting with and come out counting your fingers to see if they're all still there. He was actually a very pleasant guy. But he always had an expression of, I wish I'd been able to perfect this myself, but he had an expression of, you were left wondering what he hadn't told you, what was going on in the background. He gave you just enough information to sort of keep you on your toes.
In total, Friedrich faces 103 fraud and deception charges. Yet he's released on bail. Then, On July 26, 1991, tragedy strikes.
Police were called to the Friedrich property at Seaton in eastern Victoria after a relative discovered his body in a paddock. He had a gunshot wound to the head and a firearm lay nearby. Friends say Friedrich had been depressed recently about his forthcoming trial, at which he was expected to plead guilty to 103 fraud charges involving $265 million.
Repeated rumours about Friedrich's foreign connections and possible intelligence ties raise new questions. Did he really take his own life? Or were outside forces involved? But these rumours, too, are eventually dismissed.
Melbourne coroner has found that the former head of the National Safety Council, John Friedrich, had lived by deception and died by his own hand. During the final day of the Melbourne inquest, there were also revelations on how Friedrich had contrived his disappearance in Australia.
Friedrich is dead at 41. Left behind are his wife and children, hundreds of former employees, and enormous financial damage. Many agree on one thing. John Friedrich was clever, a visionary, someone who genuinely wanted to achieve something and who treated his employees exceptionally well. Apparently, Friedrich did not use the money he fraudulently obtained to support an extravagant lifestyle. However, during the investigation, Detective Sergeant Greg Dever discovers five brand new gold Rolex watches in Friedrich's desk drawer.
I had heard rumours that he gave them to work colleagues for really good work. That's basically only a rumour. He also is reputed to have given one of his staff members a Porsche car. But these are all things that we've only just been told. But the Rolexes were real.
In April 1990, the Canberra Times reports on court proceedings establishing that Friedrich gave a Porsche to a close employee as compensation for overtime. Nearly $300 million in debt owed to 50 financial institutions, a prominent rescue organization forced into liquidation, 450 people losing their jobs. And the man responsible can no longer be held accountable because he is dead. The public prosecutor's office decides to close the case. This leaves many questions unanswered. For example, how much responsibility lies with the financial institutions and politicians? Should they not have checked more carefully what they were providing funding and support for? This is how Fraud Squad Detective Greg Dever sees it.
You don't lend anybody money unless you do proper due diligence, proper probity. And yeah, a lot of them probably did a little bit less than what they should have.
Bruce Savage, who is used to work very closely with Friedrich, has a different take on it.
They used to line up at the office. They saw John as a really good new client who was spending lots and lots of money. You know, they were lining up at the office for John to lend money, basically. And John was very clever that way. He was telling them things that we had but we didn't have, and the banks didn't go and check it, so they just lent him the money.
Friedrich's lawyer at the time, Sig Zeller, also got a pretty good insight into the scheme Friedrich built over time.
I agree that there were contracts that needed to be looked at and there were documents that needed to be looked at, and they did exist because John created them. And that was an extraordinary part that I found about him, that he was able to produce streams and streams of documents, which on their face were valid, legitimate contracts, complicated contracts. As it turned out from the investigation, that there was no such contract that existed, just the paper.
So John Friedrich was intelligent and capable of coming up with an intricate scheme. But was he really acting alone, or did he have accomplices?
I doubt very much whether he had like a partner in crime. I think he was extremely capable and sophisticated in how he went about committing the fraud that he did. And that made him an extraordinary man, because he was able to do it in such a detailed, sophisticated way, drafting documents that any lawyer would be proud of.
Formally, the situation is clear. John Friedrich was the head of the NSCA. He made the decisions, directed operations, and signed the documents. But could one lone man really build an empire of helicopters, bases and international contracts? There was a board, committees, banks, politicians and public servants who benefited from the organization through prestige, contracts or publicity photographs. No one asked questions, no one took a closer look. And, in fact, the NSCA was doing important work for the community. In January 1988, John Friedrich was awarded the Medal of the Order of Australia in recognition of his service to the community, particularly in workplace safety and search and rescue operations. A remarkable honor for a foreign fugitive who had been living under a false name for more than a decade, while committing one of Australia's biggest frauds. Equally puzzling is that the Order of Australia can only be awarded to citizens. Yet John Friedrich had no citizenship, no valid birth certificate, and no entry on the electoral roll.
No, he wasn't an Australian citizen. Never had been, never was. He was a German citizen, born in Munich, and never ever had Australian citizenship. So how that actually happened is a bit of a mystery.
Bill Meek is the first person to publicly suspect that there was something wrong with the NSCA's finances.
Well, I guess if you can get an Order of Australia awarded to someone who is not only not Australian, but is not who he says he is, and if I was able to find that out, I shudder to think how little effort other people put into having a look at this fellow.
On November 30th, 1989, the Australian Financial Review reports from the first day of the liquidation hearing in the Supreme Court, where a supplier of containers to the NSCA testified in court. His name is John Hodges, and he is described by one of the barristers present as the paymaster of the NSCA. During the hearing, Hodges explains how an elaborate system of dummy invoices and transfers of finance company funds were arranged.
A two-way system was used to transfer funds received through Mr. Hodges Glenroy's Westpac bank account and back to the NSC or third-party beneficiaries, the court heard. After deducting the cost of the steel containers, around $11,000, he would transfer the funds to the NSC through bank checks in unmarked envelopes or through telegraphic transfers to NSC bank accounts in Traralgon or Sale. Another practice was to draw bank checks, which would then be paid to third parties as directed by Friedrich. These third parties included a number of luxury car dealers, various individuals, and a law firm. One beneficiary was Mr. Hodges. A month before the collapse of the NSC in February 1989, Mr. Hodges received an interest-free loan of $9 million from Friedrich and was told it was his for the weekend. He made $10,000 on the short-term money market. Mr. Hodges said he did wonder how the NSC would be able to purchase additional equipment for the finance companies after its expensive splurge on such items as aircraft, helicopters, dozens of luxury cars, horses, and its premises. But he said that after dealing with the company for 7 years, he believed company boards, accountants, and auditors were ensuring the proper conduct of the NSC.
Hodges also testifies that he only remembers two or three financial institutions ever contacting him about the containers. He referred all those inquiries back to the NSCA. The NSCA's strong public image created an atmosphere in which normal caution began to fade. Oversight became less rigorous, safeguards were bypassed, and scrutiny weakened. The NSCA was not viewed as a typical commercial operator, but as a valued community organization that benefited from widespread goodwill and public trust. Hugh Devin agrees.
I think it came over as a very convincing pursuit on the back of the reputation, high credibility of the NSCA Victorian section. That just had credibility from one end to the other. So I think that led to people not asking questions that they should have asked. They thought, yeah, it's okay, and the government's going to pay them some money for these aeroplanes that they've got. It would have been a fraction of what the actual costs were, and probably naively no consideration for the possibility that the normal aviation sector, who went through due process and got funding and walked over hot coals to make their business happen, was going to raise a question mark about these people getting a free run.
The NSCA saved lives and trained people who later continued working in other organizations. At the same time, part of this system was built on lies and debt. Consequences ultimately borne by others: banks, taxpayers, employees, Friedrich's family. Many looked away because what they were being shown was so extraordinary that they wanted to believe it existed, and that ultimately it was doing good for the community. Former NSCA pilot Tom Suppel.
It was a bit disappointing that such a good organisation had come and stuck and was not going to, you know, come back together. You have a lot of people lost their jobs, and I thought it was, you know, really unfortunate because it, you know, had great prospects.
At the centre of it all stands John Friedrich, the man who built an organisation of extraordinary reach and who remains to this day an enigma. Yet the fascination with him endures, as Sig Zähler, his former lawyer, explains.
It's like being a social chameleon. He was able to communicate well with many classes of people. He was able to, if you like, be a person who could read people very well. And by doing so, he could be a very strong man, a very vulnerable man, a very likable man. Really, he was tuned in to how other people would react and needed him to be in order for him to achieve what he wanted. And that sort of personality is a very powerful personality in John's case, because he could stroke people's egos quite well with the banks. He could make a person feel that he was in John's confidence. And the other thing he used very effectively is the natural trust that people have in each other in what, on the face of it, is like truth, gives a sense of truth.
This was the third and final episode of Hero or Con Man? The Case of John Friedrich from SBS Audio. Produced by Julia Greve, sound designed by Benjamin Kantak, production management by Joel Suppel. Special thanks also to SBS German, Melissa Compagnoni, and the production team behind the John Friedrich documentary, The Greatest Con Man, available on SBS On Demand. You can find more episodes of John Friedrich on the SBS Audio app or wherever you get your podcasts.